Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this session, Global Gold Standard or Fool's Gold, about the Australian wealth management industry. My name is Melinda Howes, and I'd like to introduce Wade Tubman and Annie Lau, who will be doing the presentation. Wade's the director of PricewaterhouseCoopers Actuarial Financial Services Practice. He's a fellow of the Institute and a fellow of the Financial Services Institute of Australia as well, and he has over 14 years' experience as a consultant actuary. Wade chairs the IFSA Unit Pricing Focus Group and was heavily involved in the development of the recent guidance note on asset valuation and unit pricing for infrequently valued assets. He's a regular presenter at Institute conferences, with his first appearance since returning from the UK at the Institute's Financial Services Forum in 2006 on guaranteed saving products. And Annie's a senior manager in the same team as Wade, with over 8 years' work experience, mainly in life insurance and wealth management. Last year at the Institute's Financial Services Forum, she co-presented with Wade on the topic of trouble with illiquid assets in unitised products, which over the past year has become a very hot topic. So I'll hand over now to Wade.
Thanks, Melinda. Okay, so the topic we have today is on the Australian wealth management industry. I think it might have been misrepresented in the program as the investment management industry, but we are going to be talking about sort of the wealth management industry in its entirety. And what we're trying to do here is understand whether the industry is meeting the needs of all Australians. And I guess it's a fairly lofty goal, but what we saw as the ultimate benchmark or the holy grail is the industry providing access for all Australians to a sufficient and sustainable retirement income for life? Now, obviously, throughout the course of the last 2 days and tomorrow, there's a lot of presentations that touch on aspects of this. So to sort of do this assessment, what we decided to do was get perspectives from a number of influential actuaries and also industry leaders on their thoughts on each of the areas that would affect sort of these outcomes. We interviewed them, and where sort of ideas came up for areas where Australia is a world leader, or maybe areas where Australia could take advantage of its opportunities, we actually then conducted further research, and also a number of areas overseas where we saw there might be a world best practice that Australia could learn from. We did additional research there to try and sort of see if parts of international practice could be transposed to Australia to, you know, improve some of the identified weaknesses. So throughout our presentation, we're actually going to be referring to sort of these interviews that we conducted with these actuaries and other leaders to get their perspectives, and we'll try and identify throughout the presentation where those views came from. The way we're going to divide up the presentation is to understand the path to best practice. And the way we see this path is, first of all, we look at an average Australian and how the industry is meeting the customer needs currently. Then we look at what we're calling Go for Gold. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite have the same ring to it now that we're not in Perth. But anyway, we've kept the gold theme going. And what we're looking at there is, what are the opportunities or progress Australia has made so far in this achievement of meeting customer needs? And then finally, what we're looking at in each section is the global gold standard, which is what we consider to be world's best practice. We have four sections to the presentation, and each of those represents an area where the average Australian customer has needs. So the first section is on sort of advice, education and engagement. Then we move on to product features and costs, investment management, and then finally retirement incomes and the issues there. So without further ado, I'll pass over to Annie, who's going to kick off with advice, and then we'll I'll come up later to wrap up.
Thanks, Wade. So advice. As we all heard at lunch yesterday from Bernie Ripple, advice itself is very important. But more importantly, the quality and appropriateness of the advice. There are a number of debates that we are all very familiar with. Through our interviews with the industry experts, some issues discussed were around the quality and the cost of advice, conflict of interest around the fee structures, as well as the regulatory related issues. One interviewee jokingly said that the product providers are so advisor-centric they don't design new products. they're only responsible for choosing the picture in the front of the PDS. But I'm sure that's not true. In relation to products, our interviewees recognised that Australians have the right to choose their own approach to investments for retirement, unlike some other countries. In Australia, we have access to a vast range of products with numerous choices of investment styles and options. We are currently the world leaders in platforms, which offers easy access to investors. UK is currently growing this, whilst the Americans are just coming online. But can we have too much of a good thing? Through our research, here are some facts that you may not know. Everyone knows that Australia has a lot of investment options. But did you know that there is actually more Australian equity investment options than there are companies listed on the ASX? The size of Australia's funds under management is only 2% of global FUM, but in terms of the number of investment options, we make up 13%. And two-thirds of Australia's investment options have less than 10 million in FUM, a third have less than 1 million, with a median of around 4.1 million in Australia. Surprising, isn't it? But for the average Australian, only one in five use financial planners. Only 10% have taken up SuperChoice. And of the remaining 90%, 80% are in the default investment option, which is generally the balanced option. So the big debates on advice and product ranges that I've just discussed may be largely irrelevant for the average Australian. So the real focus should be, are we meeting the needs of the average Australian? An average Australian, in terms of access, education and engagement, lacks the financial education. Most don't know much about their super. And 30%, we found, don't know their balances. I'm ashamed to say I'm one of those. And I work in the industry. The average Australian also lacks engagement to their super. As you've just heard, majority don't access their choice and remain in the default funds. And on top of that, Australians have lost touch with 6.4 million individual super accounts. So the average Australian has an education gap, an engagement gap, which leads to an overall lack of confidence in the industry. All of this is exacerbated by the accessibility and affordability of advice, as well as the complexity of our products, which obviously doesn't result in a good outcome for the average Australian. However, we are making some progress in these areas and still going for gold, which is our theme. To combat access and affordability, there is intra-fund advice. Its overall objective is to offer more readily access to simple advice about a person's investments in an existing superannuation at very low prices. For education, there are a number of programs to improve the public's financial literacy, for example, Paul Clitheroe's program. And to increase engagement, end benefit projections in super statements are already being discussed. One interviewee even suggested that with the super being compulsory, why is education and advice not? If we are forced to save, why shouldn't we be properly equipped first? Even with this progress, there are still many more things that we can do. So based on the perceived gaps in our industry, we then researched around the world for international practices that we consider global gold standard, of which there may be elements that we can learn from. First of which is the new proposed program in the UK, which may address some of our issues around access, education and engagement. It's focused on distinguishing between real independent advice and sales advice. For example, all costs must be agreed upfront to minimise conflict of interest issues. They have a new standard for independent advice and raises professional standards of all advisors. This advice model may also redirect the product manufacturer's focus back to the customers as opposed to the advisors due to its remuneration structure. The UK program also focuses on education through a money guidance program, which is available and free to all, providing investment information, not advice. There is also the Swedish system, known as the Orange Envelopes, where nationwide on an annual basis, all Swedes receive their end benefit projection statements provided by the government. So these are just two international practices that we've found which may help us here in Australia. Some of these practices may resolve some of the issues Bernie mentioned yesterday. So once the elements of access, education and engagement needs of Australians are addressed, the next area of customer need is product. So are we really meeting the needs of the average product needs of the average Australian? The average Australian can't manage their super effectively. We all know having more than one superannuation account is not cost efficient, but many Australians have more than one. From the stats that we found, more than 40% of those that try to consolidate all their super eventually give up due to the number of forms, complexity and the amount of time it takes to complete. If you were at Melinda's session yesterday, you would have heard that she recently had to go through this process. So I'm sure she'll attest to the difficulty of this, but I'm sure she didn't give up. Also, in the 21st century that we are currently in, where IT and electronics are well advanced when it comes to super, for some, it's like going back to the dark ages where checks are still being written and manual processes of superannuation contributions still exist, with long processing delays resulting in lost returns. There is a global gold standard. We believe there is. Based on our research, the Swedes appear to have the solution. The Swedish system has a national platform which offers private investment options. The platform is an open architecture platform, which is a large-scale electronic clearinghouse, processing contributions and transactions. The administration fee is only currently at 18 basis points, and they're expecting to drop this down to 4 basis points within the next 10 years. So picture this. 200 Swedes running one platform for the entire country on its investment retirement savings. So even though Sweden has a much smaller population than Australia, but maybe we can learn from this. Instead of getting the Irish backpackers to help us do the unit pricing, we'll get Swedes to run our platforms. In terms of the investment options available on this platform, it's open to an investment manager, restricting each to 25 options. So currently there are 780 investment options available. The average investment management fee is only 32 basis points, and these are determined by the managers themselves. So this all seems very cost-effective. Maybe this was achieved Senator Sherry's call for reduced fees. So what do we pay? On average, super costs approximately 120 basis points. The lower end averages coming from corporate schemes ranging around 70 basis points and higher end of retail over 2% with advice. When compared to the US, we are so much more expensive. The average equity option in the US is only 86 basis points and 74 basis points for its balanced 401k, which is the super equivalent options. But how do we stack up on the indexed options? The US can offer S&P 500 indexed options for as little as 10 basis points with Fidelity, but that's an enormous fund. But even with its smaller funds, such as California Investments of $100 million fund, can offer it at 36 basis points. The UK has a 30 basis point index fund, whilst Australia is much more expensive, with one example shown here. Vanguard offers it between 50 basis points to 75 basis points. And further researchers showed that the average fees in Australia is higher than the powerhouses like Bolivia and Uruguay. On that note, I'd like to hand back to Wade.
Yeah, Yeah, obviously a bit tongue-in-cheek there, comparing Australia to Chile. But okay, so the next question is are we meeting the investment management needs of the average Australian? Because that's what this business is all about. It's about delivering the investment returns in the accumulation phase and in the drawdown phase. One thing that really came out during our interviews is that we're probably not meeting those needs. Over the last 20 years, there's obviously been this huge shift to market-linked investments, which has, you know, really just shifted all the investment risk back on the end customers in Australia. But the interviews also showed up that, you know, it's a bit worse than this. The market risk has been exacerbated by a trend, for example, in balanced options to become a lot less balanced. This is not necessarily an Australian phenomenon. In the UK, they saw a similar trend with balance becoming not balanced and picking up an ever higher proportion of equities. So the question about the investment management and the asset allocation in Australia, one of the issues is that the end decision on asset allocation in a lot of cases is actually left up to the financial planner, or even worse, is actually left up to the investor. And we all heard earlier about a lot of your average Australian's sophistication when it comes to this. One quarter of investors don't actually understand how the share market impacts their superannuation, and half were surprised at their recent statements. And you probably would have seen a lot of this as the market crashed last year. There was a lot of stories in the paper about when the super statements came out and all the surprise that was happening. And I always, you know, found it amazing that people didn't understand that when the ASX falls to, well, you know, 50%, you know, that people didn't think that that would have any impact at all on them. But obviously they're becoming more aware. But, you know, I guess one outcome of this, and we've got a quote here, that choice may have actually forced a decision on end investors that they really weren't capable of handling. Then when we look at, say, things like multi-funds or balanced funds, where the asset allocation decisions are actually taken off the investor and done by professionals, we've actually seen that sometimes those decisions can actually be more focused on, say, outperforming a rival manager or outperforming a benchmark, which may not be relevant, rather than actually achieving the original objectives, which for a someone approaching retirement, they may have an objective of, you know, the cash rate plus a bit or inflation plus a bit. And, you know, I certainly think that there's been a trend to not achieving those. And sort of in summary, you could say that the whole process for the average Australian has actually left them with a risky exposure that's probably a bit unbalanced with their objectives. And you can see there's some pretty inflammatory comments here from some of the research and the people we spoke to. And this is an important point. It is being addressed. Some of the ideas that were put forward, you know, start ranging from the basics, actually trying to come up with standard ways of communicating risk so that your average Australian, as we know, they probably don't have advice, so they can actually understand, you know, what risks they're taking on. To prevent the sort of escalation of risk in standard options like balanced, there was a call for standard definitions of what a balanced actually is, and so you don't get this huge variation. We've all heard about the league tables that are being proposed. Maybe, again, here's another option for us to ask Senator Sherry at lunch. But one perspective was that the league tables might actually exacerbate bad behaviours because, you know, managers are going to be more and more concerned about where they sit on the league tables. And I guess in our view, it might actually encourage the bad behaviours that we've seen rather than sort of trying to shift the focus on good behaviours. In the more cutting-edge approach to asset allocation, you may have been to Zach's session yesterday or Andrew Goddard's session talking about new approaches to the asset allocation question. So it's certainly receiving traction. Whether, you know, how far that goes, it'll be interesting to see. One perspective was that industry funds are more advanced of some of the more retail balanced options in achieving this. So it'll be interesting to see whether the whole industry progresses in meeting these investment management needs or whether one group steps out first with a more innovative solution. When we look around the world at what might actually be the global gold standard for meeting investment management needs, we again look towards the UK. There's a number of different concepts there, either called new balanced, liability-driven investments, or fiduciary services. Now, all of these have different meanings in different industries. For example, liability-driven investment specifically relates to defined benefit schemes. But all of them have a similar concept. And what it is the investment manager working actually to achieve a more realistic end goal. And that end goal would be based on the actual liabilities, not an index. Now, that liability, in an individual sense, could even be CPI plus 3 for an individual. So the liabilities might be just an individual's personal liability. But we certainly have seen a lot of work done over there to try and match up the investment allocation process with the end goals. The concept of a fiduciary service is actually investment managers taking a step up from just managing the assets and actually being much more involved in the whole process, doing asset liability modelling, and actually not just coming in every year or every 3 years to have a look at things, but actually taking a lot of more responsibility to achieve the end goals. In the US, we've seen a different tact with market-linked guarantees, and the reason for this is a lot of investors do have an asymmetric risk profile, and so the assets used to back that should probably match it. A lot of the arguments against this is the cost of this, but certainly in our interviews it was identified that there are ways to reduce the cost of market-linked guarantees. And one example is that only apply market-linked guarantees to indexed options. Indexed options themselves have a lower base fee right from the start, but also it makes the hedging more effective. So you reduce the base fee cost and you also reduce the hedging cost. And you might actually be able to get away with a guaranteed option at not much more than a current active option. So this brings us round to the final question, which is, are we meeting the end retirement needs of your average Australian? Again, a bit tongue-in-cheek, but certainly one of the respondents summed it up best by saying, in retirement, the whole system is lousy. Customers receive a lot of the blame for this. A lot of people suggested that customers underprice the risks because they don't actually value the protection of market risk and longevity risk. But a counter to that might be that, if banks can't properly price risk, how can you expect an average Australian who's not financially literate to actually understand and value these risks and the protection that might be available for them? So what a lot of this has added up to is a lost generation that's entering retirement who have lacked education, engagement throughout their sort of working life and are now, lost a lot of confidence in the system. And they've been bearing the brunt of this great risk transfer over the last sort of decade or two. And, now they're coming up short when it comes to meeting their needs and goals. So going for gold, what are the opportunities here for Australia? I'm not sure how many of you were just in the session on from the Retirement Incomes Task Force, but a lot of the points we've got here are actually discussed at length in that presentation, and I'd encourage you to look at all the submissions, both from the Institute, ASFA, and some of the other presenters in that session. A lot of talk around compulsion and whether there should be some form of compulsion for a retirement income solution, and whether that compulsion should be a specific solution or more generic compulsion into some form of retirement income solution where the customer has the choice of what type of solution that is. Obviously, any solution would need to actually address the market risk and the longevity risk. We heard in the last session how important the age pension is and will continue to be. So one suggestion that was put forward was obviously to continue with the age pension and even top it up, effectively creating a nationalised annuity provider. When it comes to private sector annuities, again, a lot of debate around this, using either term certain annuities to defer a pension or a lifetime annuity for maximum security. A lot of talk around compulsion there and the advantages in reducing the cost, increasing competition, and also the requirement for relevant assets. Whether the government should issue CPI-linked bonds or longevity-linked bonds to help out the private providers. Throughout our interview program, we also heard about the potential market for reverse mortgages and sort of more modern lifetime income guarantees. One interesting stat we found was a recent survey just in February of Australians who are approaching retirement. The Milliman survey actually found that 91% of Australians near retirement like the idea of some sort of retirement income guarantee. However, only 51% of people were prepared to pay for it. So what is the global gold standard when it comes to meeting the retirement income needs? I think, to be honest, no country has achieved this, but there are some that we could look to maybe draw some interesting features. One good example might be the US, because there are a lot of similarities in the US market. They have a free market and choice for retirement savings. You've got individual products that are market-linked, and they do have this social security safety net. Obviously, one difference is the US actually has a feature whereby your social security net actually increases if you defer the start date of taking that up. And again, that was discussed in the last session. So when we look at the US, how that system works and how that might be relevant to Australia, currently 96% of variable annuities in the US offer some type of income guarantee. That guarantee might be for a fixed term or it could be for life. And aside from offering it, actually 69% of customers actually take up some sort of guarantee in this these variable annuity products. When it comes to sort of a more direct equivalent to Australian superannuation, which would be the 401k products, one in five 401k products now offer some type of income guarantee to their members. So wrapping up, what's our vision for Australia to become a global gold standard? We said before the Holy Grail was access for all Australians to a sufficient and sustainable retirement income for life. What would that vision entail? Certainly, as we mentioned throughout the presentation, access to education and some form of advice is going to be necessary for all. We're not saying that full-blown comprehensive advice is the ultimate answer, but certainly there's a huge gap there that needs to be addressed, both in financial literacy and in providing sort of more basic advice to the needs of your average person. One argument is that, it's not even an argument, superannuation is a mass market product. It's compulsory. Every Australian or every working Australian has it. So it should actually be a product simple enough to be understood by the mass market. I think I heard in one of the presentations yesterday about a car, and every Australian, a lot of Australians own a car, and you don't expect to have to read a 400-page manual just to work out if the car has brakes or not. So that was a comment that came up yesterday. But the average Australian should just be able to understand the products without having to sort of go through masses of documentation and completely re-educate themselves. Adequacy is obviously important, and we just heard how important it is for women low-income earners in the last session. When it comes to the administration, obviously enhanced systems, more electronic integration, and the industry is working towards that, but until you actually get sort of low-cost electronic streamlined processing, you're not going to be able to reduce the cost for all, and you're not going to be able to lift up engagement when you have so many people finding it too complex and just giving up interacting with their savings. When it comes to investment management, everyone really needs to understand what their needs and objectives are, and overall responsibility needs to be taken on the investment management side to make sure that that's being achieved. I personally just don't think it's good enough that we just say, your average Australian, stick him in the default, let him lose 20% and that's their problem. I think that someone needs to take a bit more sort of fiduciary responsibility for these people, because they didn't make the choice. They were forced into this product. So understanding their needs and objectives and taking responsibility. Now, whether that be the product provider, the planner, or the overall education system, but someone needs to take more responsibility for that. and also managing investment risk and allowing people the choice of mitigating it, so more product options there. And also when it comes to retirement incomes, obviously a range of options should be available there, and providing a sort of a toolkit for people to manage market and longevity risk. How might we do this? Obviously it's no one group is ever going to be able to address this. The industry, government and the regulators are all going to need to continue to work together, and they're all going to have to expand their vision to make sure that we're actually addressing the real needs of all Australians. As an example, we heard at lunch yesterday about a lot of the issues with advice and the financial planners, and that's a really, really good initiative, but really needs to be lifted up from that and look at the 80% of people who are non-advised and what are we going to do about them. So I guess in conclusion, there's got to be a lot more discussion and a lot higher level goals debated if we're going to actually achieve this global gold standard. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Wade. Thanks, Danny. I might just open it up now for questions from the floor. Who'd like to ask the first one? Okay, well, while you're thinking about... Oh, we've got one there, Anthony. And please just state who you are for the recording.
Thanks, Melinda. It's Anthony Asher. And congratulations. That's a great. That was really interesting and stimulating paper. And it gives me great pleasure as a competitor to sort of say I agreed with virtually everything you said in that, although I'm a favour rather of with-profit annuities rather than the guaranteed American standard, which, but I'm more familiar with the British and South African system where with-profit annuities work very well. Can I say that I think the challenge to us, the last bit you said that government, industry and profession needs to work together. I was outraged by Harmer suggesting, in the Harmer Commission it suggests, that the private sector has been inadequate in its provision of benefits on the income stream side, and that there's therefore a need for government provision. Now, I think we should say very clearly, and I put the call out to actuaries of the world, unite. We can't be allowed to be pushed around in the way of this. Cathy, you made the point about the regulations that make it difficult to do income stream development. With-profit annuity was not legal in Australia till last year when you got the account balance position, and even now the lawyers are debating as to whether it's possible or not. It's an outrage. We had sorted out, the profession had sorted out illustrations and projections for retirement by the late 80s. Why don't we have it now? Because your lawyers will tell you that the ASIC regulations don't allow you to give the projections. I agree with you entirely that without projections, the whole advice thing is a bit of a joke. Now, I mean, we sit with thousands of pages of legislation drafted by people in Treasury, or in APRA, or in ASIC, and they have missed the point in many respects. And I think actuaries, being wise very often, a little bit comfortable very often, tentative in what we say, have allowed ourselves to be pushed around by vested interests and people who really haven't grasped the essence of the plan. And I would like to suggest that we should really put aside some of our differences, try and work to out some of the sort of rather minor issues that we face sometimes, and sit down, take a deputation to Senator Sherry. Perhaps we should do it at lunchtime, but I think it may be a little bit too to get it organised. Too soon to get it organised. But really say, look, you've done the measure here. People are not really impressed with the Australian system. Let's stop pretending that it's anywhere near the gold standard in a number of material places. And let's address these issues. Firstly, get government out of our hair. Then let's see where we can move on that score. I don't think the industry is lazy. The industry is absolutely overwhelmed by an excess of regulation.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd see the solution to that being what I said at the end in terms of the government can't blame industry. This can't be this blame game. I think everyone needs to take the responsibility and lift the vision up, so I'd agree with that.
Do we have any other questions or comments?
Mark Berry, just following on from that. I quite like the comment, we have to remove the barriers to engagement, because sometimes when you get involved in the superannuation system. You know, people receive their annual statement and it's very confusing, even sometimes for an advisor to sort of try and work out what's actually going on. When you stand back and look at it just high level and reflect on it, to me, I sort of see a whole lot of investment opportunities sort of existing over here, whether they be boring term deposits or cash or, you know, resource shares or aeroplanes or shipping ports or toll roads. Well, there's all this sort of investment activity that's sort of going on over here. Then over here you've got people, you know, saving for their retirement. So there's that money sort of flowing into super funds and that system. And then it's a matter of how you actually connect that money with these investment opportunities. And in a way, it's also then coming back to giving the consumer or the member the information that they can have so they can sort of get engaged in that process. Now, whether they do that by investing through a managed fund or whether they do that by investing directly and buying shares, I think when I look at it, what we need is more regulation to sort of drive accountability for that flow of information, because I think it does get very clouded. Now, we stand here, and I mean, people are quite cynical towards financial planners, and I'm a financial planner, but I can see sort of working out there, I can see a lot of financial planners are actually remunerated by their product providers or by the organisations, and there's not really too many that work for the consumer. And I think when you sort of look at that, we're in a world now where we're going to maybe change that and have more where the consumer needs sort of more input into the process, but it's got to kind of be modelled down to people's kind of level of understanding. And I think when I sort of stand back and look at it, there's sort of degrees of regulation that you need to sort of go through there. And I think when I stand back and just reflect a bit more and look at what happens inside ASIC and those systems, that they tend to be very legally based. So you have a lot of legally qualified people coming around sort of trying to do things, and you don't have sort of too many, maybe I'd use the word engineers, or people that actually sort of understand what's happening underneath, involved in that process. So I think sort of to summarise my sort of thing, I think I'd like to sort of see sort of more regulation to sort of drive that accountability process from the consumer to the investor. But there must be a way to sort of do that so it's not too overwhelming. Because I think Australians are reasonably educated now. We're not always... The quality of understanding amongst consumers is probably far greater than what you actually maybe put across here.
Yep. Yeah, I certainly probably did play up the average Australian as being a bit lower standard than they actually are. But, you know, I think I agree. And on the sort of legislation or regulation side from ASIC, you know, obviously we've seen PDSs grow and grow and grow and statement of advisors. And, you know, I think that we can sort of come up with a better approach to that. I still think that, you know, more regulation might not be the answer to that, because regulation has just resulted in where we are now. And, you know, if we end up with short form PDS, is brilliant, but you've still got to come back to the basic thing is, you know, certainly I know a lot of people that wouldn't even read a 10-page PDS and wouldn't understand it. So I think it is a move in the right direction, but I don't think regulation is the only answer. I think you've got to go back to more basics and say, would it actually achieve the goals for your average Australian or below average Australian then?
Okay, we might just take one more question. And while you're coming up, I think ASIC, encouragingly, they've got some practitioners getting into their teams now, so they are starting to address those issues Mark was mentioning.
Bruce Thompson, and this probably isn't a question, more I'm surprised in myself to say, I suspect a defence of the balanced option. Both Annie and Wade have mentioned how I think it was 90% of people have ended up in the balanced option. Some of them, I suspect, have been an active decision. They have actually looked at it and decided, yes, this is the place for me. But given the lack of education of the great unwashed, I'm actually quite comfortable that they've ended up in the balanced option. And further than that, I hope they're still there in 2 or 5 years from now so that they can benefit from what, in my view, will be a recovery of that 20% that they've lost in recent times. So whilst a little bit of knowledge might be a dangerous thing, I suspect no knowledge has left them where I'm quite comfortable for them to sit.
You know, like, I'm not saying the balanced option doesn't have a place. I guess, as you call them, the great unwashed, I think there are a lot of people who probably didn't quite understand the risk in the balanced option. And if they did make an active choice that they wanted that option and they were comfortable with the risk profile, I completely agree with you. But I do get the feeling that there is a lot that didn't understand the risk profile and didn't understand what the balanced option was. And they were those 50% of people who were surprised by their statement. So I agree with you. that it's an important thing and people choose into it. But I think that those that don't choose into it, that's where, you know, I was really coming from.
Oh, could you go back to the mic, please, for the recording? Thanks, Bruce.
Still Bruce. My thought is, yes, they were imbalanced because of, well, a default option, and I think that that possibly means that trustees or employers have actually done a good job in choosing the appropriate default option. But my thought is, if they weren't imbalanced, if they did know where they wanted to be, etc., etc., where else would I want them to be? And my answer is no, I think that the average Australian should be in the balanced. Mm. Then they probably should be in something more aggressive, you're suggesting? Yeah, well, 60 doesn't worry me.
We are starting to see some of those graduated default funds now that start off more aggressive and get less. So, well, I think that's been a very interesting discussion. Do we have a final brief question or comment before we wrap up?
Come on, Zach. Let's hear it.
First time, I'd like to thank you for organising your dress together before you...
Yeah. Didn't you all get the email? It's Pink Shirt Day.
Zach Roberts, one comment about the Swedish approach of having the government have the platform. I think that's fantastic for two reasons. One is that it results in cheaper costs for the investors. And two is that if the government ran a platform, then the wealth managers could potentially stop focusing on platform and administration and marketing and things like that and focus back on what they're meant to be doing, which is achieving returns consistent with the investors' objectives. And my only issue with balanced funds is that very, very few of them actually attempt to do what they state in their targets is their goal. You know, so fine being a balanced fund, but if you're in one and think it's doing what it says it's, you know, aiming to do, then you can be sorely disappointed.
Can I just do a bit of a straw poll? Who thinks here thinks the government would do a great job at running an admin system for the super industry? Oh, there's a couple. I'm not putting mine up. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Annie and I were joking. We said get a plane load of the blonde Swedes out here and set them up. And
Ben and Helen.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you. It's been a very interesting discussion. Please join me in thanking...